She approached me in the grocery store. I live for those moments. Really, I do. I live for those moments that transect the borders between persons, that prove we are connected no matter the fabrications of wholly self-centered lives. I imagined her opening question, "Where did I get my shoes? Could I reach something on the top shelf? Did I have the time?" I could not have predicted the question that did arise. Did I know the name for the Mother of God? Did I know the name for the Mother of God? The smile I was shining, encouraging her engagement, twisted with irony. I could guess where she was going with this. That open countenance I wear had won me another one of those conversations. You've had those conversations, right? You can say it. Have you had those conversations? Yes? Yes? Or perhaps it was just my moth-eaten t-shirt and the sweat from the walk to the store. Maybe I looked like I needed saving. The struggle I had in those next few moments was not as predictable as it once was, not as direct, as explicit. I'm not averse, not any longer, to proselytizing in itself. The banal act of sharing the good news, winning souls for Jesus or Jews for Jehovah at the Chabad house. I used to fling my self-righteousness at the Jehovah's Witness, but now as a minister representing one of the many struggling, theologically liberal denominations in America, I've found more reason to disdain the act of hiding than the act of evangelizing. Our people hide. We hide. We wait for the seekers. We wait for them to grow enlightened enough to see their own way through the world's darkness to our doors. We know we have seen the mountain, but we're not going to pride ourselves on being a place worth finding. They say, "I never knew a place like this existed." And we say, "I didn't either before I came," without entertaining the lesson in the interchange. When we hear that our numbers have stayed flat while our population of our county has doubled, tripled, we think about updating our website, right? Or we wonder if our religious education program is flashy enough to attract millennials. But rarely do we turn inward to consider the way we, in our faithfulness or lack thereof, project or fail to project a real confidence in ourselves and our religious enterprise. When did we lose our faith? About 1 month before our numbers went flat. But that's the logical answer, not the reflective one. And it's the reflective answer that we need to understand the core of liberal religion. What we're about is to understand the liberal religious project, what birthed this manner of being religious. Ours was always an answer, a different answer, to the question that humanity couldn't, through all of its being, stop asking. Orthodoxy, fundamentalism, even clericalism and expediency answered the question with a full stop, an unquestionable authority. There's a mountain, and if you're going to find it, you have to do X, Y, and Z. Liberalism said, "Yeah, but don't you see, we're human, we're fallible. Even if the Holy is speaking to us, even if the Holy walked on earth, do you really think we could hear the wisdom unbiasedly? Seek the mountain, but do it from that place of humility." Liberal religionists, if they are to be true to their project, always remain in a conversation, a debate even, with their most cherished conclusions. Without this, they can't be open to the ever-accessible imminency of revelation. Without this, they fail the first test of their confession, to listen not for the voice that will end all questioning, but for the sly truth, the truth that does not level complexity but speaks within and through it, the truth that is easier to find in poetry or a bar of music than in the rote recitation of prose. This is a beautiful and a necessary project, this liberal religion. So why, when it is so beautiful and necessary, are we so embarrassed to tell our neighbor, our friend, or stranger in the grocery store with conviction and clarity all about the faith that calls us to this project? I know you have that. You show up in a freezing cold building on Sunday morning at 9:30 a.m. You know that there's something worth coming to here. Why is it so hard to talk about? Why are we bereft of the words that convey that there is a way to be religious without the tearing the truth of our bodies from the truth of our souls? Without carving up vaster and craggier divisions between the saved and the unsaved, the believers and the heretics, the believers and the infidel? Why do we fail to project the faith that our project is about uniting the human family, not around a common belief, but around a call to respect the inherent worth and dignity of all people, while honoring a God or universe that is big enough, wise enough, and hospitable enough to recognize life's inherent call to diversity, not as anathema, but as holiness incarnate? Why, when there is such beauty and necessity in this project, and to be honest, such ugliness, and I'm being really honest here, such evil in the ideas of that strict fundamentalism that says there are some saved and some lost, are we too embarrassed to pronounce this faith as worthy, as our own, and as available to others? The woman in the grocery store wasn't embarrassed, nor was she unprepared for me. She asked, "Who was the mother of God?" "Sophia," I said, like a good seminarian, surprised that I could use all those hours I poured into biblical literacy to ace this test. "Sophia," I said, personified as wisdom and woman, even mother of God or God's mother or partner or the female force of God in the world, depending on your century, on your lens of interpretation. But her face didn't portray my victory. It portrayed her disdain. "No," she said, and immediately took another tact. She was done with the questions. She would tell me what I needed to hear. I engaged a bit more later in the conversation when she said that God's only name was Elohim. "It's a good name," I thought. "I pray through that name, like breath, El, the intake, O, the pause, and Heem, the exhale." But before I could get the Yah out for Yahweh, she was on to her concluding point. The words that I needed to hear, that she needed to leave me with, the cornerstone of her faith, the revelation I'm assuming of her cult. "The mother of God is named Jerusalem," she said. "Remember that," she said. "I will. I imagine I will remember that. I'll remember it like a broken record, spinning around the same mote of dust, repeating ad nauseam some insignificance as if it were all the record had to say. I will remember that as I remember every conclusion, every ending that dares promise the cessation of revelation, whether secular, like materialism's claim that we are chemical machines, or religious, like fundamentalism's claim that God's love is limited to the few, to the believers. I will hear it as an utter fail. My good liberal religious folk, we grew too embarrassed to engage this conversation sometime in the 50s, maybe before. We grew embarrassed proportionally to the rise of fundamentalism. And here's the kicker. They, the fundamentalists, originally rose their voices to counter our own. We'd been the mainstream. Tillich, the great mid-century religious liberal theologian, was once a household name. Most people had his book on their bookshelf. The fundamentalists held on so tightly and so loudly to their fundamentals to defend against us. The liberal threat, the supposed humanist revolution, the fear-mongered secularization of the world, because they feared that we were winning. But the louder they shouted, the quieter we grew. They were fighting against us, and we thought we were choosing pacifism, the respectable path, but what we were choosing, in the end, was indifference, faithlessness. Like the still small voice, we apologized. We need to whisper our truth. If they shout, demand, insist, we'll sound like them if we do the same. We'll sound ridiculous, unintelligent, unschooled. We'll sound emotional. It's like they really believe what they're saying. How last century. How primitive. And to save our well-heeled intellectual appearance, we, embarrassed by the buffoonery of those who claimed our office, bargained away our faithfulness. We slunk down quiet to show how different we were. Sometimes when friends from my childhood betray their surprise that I am a minister, remember, they saw me in high school, I'm tempted, achingly really, to say, but not that kind of minister. This is how I wear the embarrassment of my office. This is how we kill our project, how we hide our congregations, how we lose our faith. If I'm being real, and I sense I need to be real because I see how these evil ideas are working their way around our world, if I don't let my embarrassment speak but let my call speak, I must profess with certainty that indeed I am that kind of minister. Because it is all the things that we liberal religionists share with the more orthodox that make my project as a minister necessary, and all the things we don't share that demand that as a liberal minister I enter the fray and stake my claim. I, like them, am called to the work of salvation, to save us from ourselves. Our blindness, our ego, to save myself from the inertia of fear, the indifference of silence, to save humanity from the evils of prejudice, racism, oppression that grow like a fungus on the surface of our world, obscuring the truth of our inner relation and utter dependence on the whole. I am in the business of salvation, and today in this fundamentalism, ravaged world, broken by the simplification of the divine, bloodied by the dangerous images of righteousness, I am in the business of saving us from people like me. Those people who stop us in the grocery store, knock on our doors, profess on our television and radio with a callous and dangerous certainty, dangerous, that threatens to rip us from our souls. I'm in the business of saving us from them, not because they are willing to share their truth with emotion, but because of the truth they are sharing. I'm in the business of saving us from them, not because I hold every truth in the palm of my hand. I sure don't. Not because their manner is coarse, but because their doctrines are literally killing us. These doctrines that you have to believe for fear if you don't, you will be hated by God. Doctrines that say God's love is limited. Doctrines that propose to speak for the holy. Doctrines that call the faithful to kill in God's name and desecrate this earth. These doctrines are evil ideas. Do you hear me? I'm in the business of saving this world from fundamentalism's desperate grasping after conclusions too thin to hold the complexity of being, too tight to honor the sanctity of diversity, too base to raise us up from the morass of our ego-driven desecration of our world, our species, and ourselves. And I believe you are in that same business as well. Sure, I'm tired of speaking my truth to the fundamentalist because she is not in the business of listening. And that chafes at my liberal sensibilities. But perhaps I shouldn't be in the business of listening either. Not always. Not when it comes to some of what she spills. The vitriol, our faith, our beautiful and necessary faith, demands we declare as anathema. The question is not, if I take this stand, can I still call myself a liberal minister? The question is, if I don't take this stand, can I call myself a minister at all? Amen. Barbara's going to come forward and help us out with a tune called Hush. This is 1040 in your teal hymnals. We may stumble a bit at the beginning, but we're going to catch this one and roll with it. I welcome you to rise and